It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here as we look at the spread of a protest movement in Iran and what these demonstrations mean after the death of 22-year-old Mahsa Amini last month, not fully covering her hair with a hijab as mandated by the country's so-called morality police. We explore why her death has struck a nerve in Iran, what may happen in the future after these demonstrations. 800-642-1234. Roya Hakakian is an author and poet who fled her country of Iran in 1984. Roya, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Well, wearing a headscarf became law, as you are well aware, in 1983 in the theocratic regime. What effects has this dress code have had on women's lives?
Well, as you can imagine, being a woman, we all, being human beings, we all want to choose how we dress. It's the most important expression of our selfhoods. We tell the world who we are through what we wear. And imagine someone else, some other ruler telling you how it is that you can actually appear, which in the case of Iran is you become sort of a faceless person in a sea of other people. But it is not simply a matter of stripping someone of the ability to express themselves. It's also a symbol of subjugation. When women are forced under the hijab, they are forced to be faceless, shapeless. And as a result, the position that's socially imposed upon women, which is the position of a second-class citizen, sinks in much more easily along with the way women appear in public. So it has been one of the worst things that has happened to Iranian women, if not the worst, since 1979. And I'm not surprised that this generation can no longer tolerate it.
As you watch the images coming out of your homeland, I'm wondering what goes through your mind as you see women taking off their headscarves, you know, twirling them above their heads, cutting their hair. What do you make of these images?
It's truly amazing. I am not surprised on one hand, because when I was 17 and 18 and I was forced under the hijab in Iran, I felt angry enough to do the very same things. So I'm not surprised. But I'm also awed, because I don't think I would ever dare to do what these women are doing. The amount of fearlessness, the amount of courage that they're showing to come out in public, young girls, you know, 16, 17, and to do what they're doing in the face of armed men, riot police, you know, these institutions that have thus far struck fear in the hearts of Iranian people, no longer work. And I think that is the most amazing development I have seen in the past 40 years. And I really bow my head to all these women and men who are out on the streets fighting.
When you were a young person, a teenager in Iran, what was it like to be questioned by the morality police? Were you ever questioned?
All the time. Mm. All the time. You know, Mahsa Amini, the girl who was detained by the morality police and then died in the custody of the morality police, was an entirely ordinary person. In various reports that we have read about her, we read, and it's been reported that she wasn't covering her hair. I know through a reporter who's been in touch with her family that no, that was not the case. Her hair was covered with the scarf. It was the fact that the bottom two buttons of her Islamic uniform were open. And that's what they picked on. So, you know, this is to say that when I was, when I was a teenager, as you can see from the case of Mahsa, you don't have to do very much to be questioned and to be detained. And it is very terrifying. And it makes life quite miserable. And it isn't simply that you're necessarily doing something wrong. It's also that, you know, if they put morality police on the street, they have to, you know, deliver a statement to the public that's passing by. And so every once in a while, they have to make an example of somebody, you know, pick on a person, detain them, question them, take them away. And it just makes life, ordinary life that ought to be without these unnecessary fears, entirely terrifying.
If you're just joining us, we're discussing the uprisings in Iran with poet and journalist Roya Hekakian. You can join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. Roya, why did you leave Iran?
Well, I had graduated high school. Mm-hmm. The war between Iran and Iraq was at a peak. It was in its fourth year. In 1984. And the future was very bleak. You know, it didn't look like the war was going to end. Iran was under sanctions by the entire, by the entire Western world. We were hearing red sirens to go hunker down in shelters on a daily basis. And I'm also Jewish, and therefore, I had several strikes against me. I was a woman, I was a Jew, and in a country that was at war. So it didn't look like staying there was going to, in any way, shape, or form, give me or my family a bright future. So we decided to leave. And part of what you hear from these young demonstrators on the streets is that if they don't come out to the streets and overthrow the regime and change this system, they too have no future. And this is as much a struggle for their present as it is for them to make a better future possible for themselves.
What seems to be remarkable is how conservative and liberal Iranians have seemed to come together in this moment. What do you notice there?
It is quite exciting because in every possible realm, I have observed this solidarity that I haven't seen in the past 40 years. Even in the silly social media, I see people being very supportive of each other, retweeting each other's messages, giving each other encouragement. And then within the country, it's been astounding. For years and years, we have heard from the regime and from people who support the regime that, Iran will be separated and fall apart because there are all these ethnic minorities who believe in this separatist agenda. And, the Kurds want to go start their own nation and their own country. And, the Baluchis and the Azeris and all these other, ethnicities want to go off and start their own countries. And so if this bad regime were to go, everything would fall apart. And so, by instilling that fear, they have basically silenced people and cowed them into submission. What's been amazing in the past 4 weeks is that all of these ethnicities, all of these groups who we had been told to fear because mm-hmm. they wanted to separate from the rest of the country, have come together. You hear chants in support of the Kurds in the streets of Azerbaijan, you hear chants in support of the Azeris in the heart of the Balochistan. So it has been an astounding demonstration of universal support and solidarity within the country, of the kind that I only remember from my childhood in 1978 and 1979 during, you know, the revolution. The original revolution.
Mm-hmm. Iranian-American poet and author Roya Hekakian with us on her perspective of the unrest unfolding in Iran, what it means for the future of the Islamic regime, its morality police. Her recent article in The Atlantic is called The Bonfire of the Headscarves. Join in 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. More women are risking their lives on the streets of Iran. We explore the fight for women's freedoms, especially after the death of Mahsa Amini last month. Videos coming out of Iran on social media of these protests show women waving their headscarves above their heads in solidarity. We have Roya Hekakian, who is an author and poet. Her latest book is called A Beginner's Guide to America, and she stays with us. Roya, let's turn to Western nations. In your column in The Atlantic, you argue that Iranians will not be able to win their freedom without support from Western nations. What would you like to see the U.S. do to help?
Well, first of all, let's kind of look at, you know, the trend of revolutions we've seen throughout the world in the past 10, 20 years. I cannot recall, with the exception of perhaps one or two examples, any one of them succeeding on their own, especially against a heavily armed and historically brutal military apparatus without the support of the international community. So there is only so much that an unarmed nation can do against a very heavily armed adversary, such as, you know, the regime in Iran at the moment. So we have to kind of think, as Americans, as Westerners who believe in democratic values, as feminists who must see this struggle as a continuation of women's struggle everywhere in the world, which began almost 100 years ago, going on in Iran, unfolding at the moment. And so if our sisterhood is global, in fact, and if we believe that one struggle it supports the next struggle for freedom, for egalitarian values, then we must do everything we can to support democratic activists, to support the sentiment for freedom, liberty, and egalitarian values in Iran. In the same way that we decided that the struggle in Ukraine, the fight that the Ukrainians are waging against the Russians, is ultimately a fight for democracy for the rest of the world too. So I think we ought to do everything we can. So, you know, Iranians lose internet all the time. The regime shuts down the internet, and it's terrifying because obviously when the news doesn't come out of Iran, it often means that the riot police, the military forces are out on the streets killing people. So if we want to bring in a small measure of safety, at least we have to make sure that people stay connected to the rest of us. I think placing all the people who are carrying out these violent activities on the streets on a list of sanctions is pretty important. We have done that as in the past couple of weeks. The State Department added several names to the list of sanctions. I think, you know, other Western European nations, who have embassies in Iran should cut diplomatic ties when they see 16 and 17 year olds coming out on the streets unarmed and being shot to death. So there's a whole lot we can do.
Very quickly, because we're almost out of time, but if the Iranian government is overturned or reformed, what do you hope will replace it?
I am not sure. I think there are, I don't think anybody knows, but I think there will be hopefully a referendum in the same way that there was a referendum in 1979. And people would choose which form of government they wish to have. You know, in 1979, there was a question on the ballot. Do you wish to have the Islamic Republic or no? And people chose an Islamic Republic. And it seems very much that people no longer want to mix religion with the affairs of the state, that they want a separation of the two institutions. And I think we start with a referendum and take it from there.
Roya, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Roya Hekakian is a journalist and poet. Her latest book is called A Beginner's Guide to America for the Immigrant and the Curious. Now, Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes sailed through the Democratic primary in Wisconsin's U.S. Senate race, thanks in part to his progressive record and prominent liberal endorsements. But the very things that made him a favorite among the Democratic base have been attacked as liabilities in his campaign against Republican U.S. Senator Ron Johnson. Rich Kramer reports.
On a rural St. Croix County farm in mid-September, a small crowd of Democrats have come to rally behind Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes. Minnesota U.S. Senator Amy Klobuchar is the featured speaker. She praises Barnes and says he would compliment Wisconsin's other senator, Democrat Tammy Baldwin.
And in my mind, you shouldn't have one incredible, awesome, respected U.S. senator out of the state of Wisconsin. You should have two.
Barnes won the Democratic primary for Senate with endorsements from progressive icons like U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. Klobuchar is a different kind of Democrat. She's run as a moderate, and at this rally, she's appealing to a different kind of voter.
And you tell your friends, whether they are independents, moderate Republicans in this district, a district that has supported Democrats in the past, you tell them our very democracy is on the line.
But in a hyper-competitive state like Wisconsin, that's easier said than done. Since the primary, Barnes has been hit with a wave of Republican attack ads describing him as a radical liberal. And they appear to have made a mark.
The Republicans are putting on a clinic right now.
That's UW La Crosse political science professor Anthony Chergosky.
They are putting on a case study in how to run an effective negative campaign against an opponent.
The main attacks against Barnes have portrayed him as soft on crime.
Do you feel safe? Mandela Barnes would eliminate cash bail.
Some show video of him suggesting funding from law enforcement can be shifted to pay for social services. Others highlight his calls 4 years ago to cut the prison population in half. Republicans have amplified their message with money. An analysis by the watchdog group Open Secrets shows that between the candidates and outside groups, Republicans have outspent Democrats by roughly $20 million. Democratic strategist Joe Zepecki says despite that, it's still a close race between Johnson and Barnes. He says Democrats at the national level should take notice.
In the 11 elections statewide since Donald Trump won in 2016, the Democratic candidate or the Democratic-backed candidate has won 10 of them. 10 of 11. We know how to win here, but we need the resources to do it.
This month, the Barnes campaign is trying to shift voters' focus back to Ron Johnson. They've run ads highlighting Johnson's long anti-abortion record.
But it's Johnson's views that are alarming. Johnson supported a ban on abortions.
And Barnes has taken that message on the road. During a stop last week at an Eau Claire cafe, Barnes met with a group of women to talk about the U.S. Supreme Court's ruling that struck down Roe v. Wade. He says Johnson's past votes for a national abortion ban are too extreme for Wisconsin.
The reality is Ron Johnson is just not there for us, and he is not the person to be trusted when it comes to women's health.
The UW La Crosse's Chergosky says the counterattack could mean the race hinges on a sliver of independent voters. He says they'll have to decide whether they see Barnes as a candidate who has said things about public safety that make them uncomfortable, or whether they see Johnson as a candidate out of step with the public on abortion. Rich Kramer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And WPR's profile of U.S. Senator Ron Johnson aired yesterday. You can find both stories at WPR.org. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. Taking steps toward a sustainable Halloween on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here. According to the National Retail Federation, we will shell out in excess of $10 billion this year on the mountains of costumes and decorations, all the hundreds of millions of pounds of candy giving our kiddos a sugar high for weeks on end. How do you try to reduce your waste during the holidays? What works for Halloween? Do you hand out eco-friendly candy? What does that mean? It's 800-642-1234. Lines are open for you. Stephanie Moram is founder of Good Girl Gone Green. Her company teaches us how to live greener and more sustainable lives. She also is the host of the podcast Green Junkie. Stephanie, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
So what does a sustainable Halloween really mean? What does that look like to you?
Well, in all actuality, it's hard to have, you know, a perfect sustainable Halloween just because there is a lot of waste associated with Halloween. But there are things that us as consumers can do to reduce our waste so that it's not as wasteful. And I think one of the first things is to kind of look at what your kids or yourself are dressing up for Halloween, and how can you not go and buy a new costume and then, you know, end up just discarding it after? What are some things that you can do? So I always recommend that you go thrift shopping. Just go to a thrift store and find a costume that maybe somebody donated the year before, or make your own. You can a quick Google search and you can find countless ideas on how to make your own costumes. And when you're thrift shopping, it's less expensive than going out and buying a brand new costume, to be honest, right? And your kids are wearing it maybe once at school, and then once if they go to school, and then once when they're trick-or-treating. And then it's being discarded.
And the vast majority of costumes, as you mentioned, they end up in the landfill, millions of tons each year. And these costumes can also be quite unhealthy for us and the environment. I learned the Ecology Center in Michigan tested costumes, and they found that they can be really toxic, containing lead, containing PVC, flame retardants. How should we approach these costumes?
I think it's hard to avoid, you know, a lot of stuff is made not in the United States, not in Canada, not in North America. So it's sometimes, you know, a lot, even our clothing, we could talk about clothing all day too, is containing those, a lot of those ingredients as well. I think that's just a mass problem. But it's, you know, if you're buying secondhand, wash your clothes. When I wash anything from a thrift store, whether it's Halloween or just thrifting, I kind of strip my clothing, and all that is I stick my clothing in a tub. I add some baking soda. I might add some vinegar. And I just kind of let it soak to just kind of get those smells at least out of the clothing.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I think thrifting is really the way to go. Like my daughter last year, she dressed up as a zombie schoolgirl. We went to the thrift store. She bought some tights. We cut them up. She bought a shirt. We cut it up. We put her hair all messy. I put some black makeup on her face and on her clothing to look like she was dirty. And she had a black skirt at home, and that's what she dressed up as. And we bought a tie, and we ripped up the tie. And this year she wants to do the same type of thing, like a zombie-type costume. We're going to go to the thrift store. And my son wants to dress up as a prisoner. So I found so far half of his costume. But, you know, it's kind of cleaning your clothing mm-hmm. before you put them on, definitely. And then if you're buying secondhand, they've probably been washed a couple of times. So hopefully some of those toxins have dissipated a little bit out of the clothing.
Yeah.
And you can also hang your clothing outside, just kind of air them out a little bit to try to get the smells off and get all that off the clothing as much as possible.
Well, let's bring in Michelle in Janesville with a tip. Hi, Michelle. What are you giving out at Halloween?
So we, for the last 2 years, have given out children's books for Halloween.
Oh, that is wonderful. So how do you gather enough children's books? Because, you know, lots of kiddos coming to the door.
Right. So my husband and I are both teachers and both kind of book hoarders. And we've got, I'm not going to reveal my sources, but we've got some freebie opportunities plus really cheap places that we get books. Garage sales are great. In 2019, we gave out about 50 books and then ran out and had to shut our lights off.
Oh.
And last year, we didn't do Halloween because of the pandemic. This year, I've got about 5 boxes, so probably 300 books that we're going to give out.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah, the kids love it.
I was going to say, are they disappointed that they don't, you know, find candy at your door when they ring the doorbell?
They are actually more excited about the books. Yeah. We had a boy show up 2 years ago. And he said, oh, I heard you were giving out books, because by that time I had to pull out the bag of suckers. And I said, yeah, honey, we ran out. And he's like, oh, well, thank you anyway.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, Michelle, thank you for that tip. Stephanie, how about that, giving out books?
I love that idea of giving out books. I think the kids get so much candy, right? Like, my kids don't keep all the candy. We separate it all. We give it away if we have, you know, we give it away or my husband eats it. But we don't keep all that candy. And most of the candy, you know, no fault to anyone else, but like most Halloween candy is full of high fructose corn syrup, red dyes, blue dyes, all stuff I personally don't want my kids eating tons of. So I allow them to, you know, pick like 10 candies. There might be some listeners thinking, horrible mom, only let them get 10 candies. I have a backup plan. I buy organic candy for them. But I let them pick a bunch of candy, but just so much of the Halloween candy is just so not good for us. And I think that's the other problem that comes with Halloween, is that these candies are just filled with toxic ingredients, you know? And so there are definitely other alternatives out there. I'm happy to share a couple of alternatives of better candy.
Yeah. What do you have for us?
So one of my favorites is called Yum Earth. They make lollipops, and whenever there's a holiday, they make specific like gummies for that holiday. So I bought some lollipops. They actually made, it's really cute, instead of calling them Skittles, they call them Giggles. And they were so cute. So my kids are like, can I have a giggle? I'm like, you can have a giggle. So they're organic. There's also Made Good. They make granola bars.
Mm-hmm.
And around Halloween, they made smaller versions of the granola bars. They're all organic. There's a brand called Unreal Candy. So they make more traditional candy, but with better ingredients without the high fructose corn syrup in it. You can also get Annie's Bunnies, a little bit more expensive, but they're like little bunnies that are gummies.
Okay.
Then you have Wholesome, which is another brand, organic brand, and then you have Surf Sweet. So they're better brands. They're still candy, right? There's still sugar in it, but it's not containing all those dyes that come with traditional candy.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with eco-friendly expert Stephanie Moram about how to reduce waste at Halloween. And Stephanie runs a company out of Canada focusing on living a greener life. You can join in on your tips. How are you trying to reduce waste at Halloween or Thanksgiving, other holidays? Do you hand out eco-friendly candy? What is it? Or maybe you give books or something else besides candy. Join in at 800-642-1234. For your ideas, welcome. Stephanie, you know, what about fair trade? And, you know, you mentioned a bunch of organic labels, but buying chocolate, we should probably also think about where that chocolate is coming from.
Definitely. So there are chocolate companies that use Faraday chocolate. And what that just means is that the people that are making that chocolate, how it's being produced, because we don't make chocolate in Canada, the United States, we don't get cocoa beans here, so we do have to get them from other countries. So the whole process of how you get that how you get the cacao, essentially, and how it's being made and who's making it is done in a way where the people making it are paid fair wages. They're not paid unfair wages. So in the chocolate industry, you know, I won't name any of the big brands, but there's a lot of big brands that, you know, it's exploitation, right? They're exploiting these people in other countries to get chocolate and get it at cheaper rates. But there's companies out there that do it in a fair way where the chocolate is, they're paying them fair wages, like I said. So there are brands out there that will produce their chocolate and it'll say like fair trade certified on it. And a lot of those companies also get organic chocolate as well. So when it comes to chocolate, whether it's Halloween, whether it's another holiday, I'm always 100% buying fair trade chocolate.
What about all the individual wrappers and thinking just how many of those wrappers are winding up in the landfill?
It's crazy. It's insane how much Halloween, like you said at the beginning, how much waste is associated with Halloween. I think, you know, there's an option out there. It's a company called TerraCycle. It's available in Canada and the United States, T-E-R-R-A Cycle.
Mm-hmm.
And what they do is they don't just take candy wrappers, they take any waste. And I don't know if you ever noticed, if you go to like Staples or any of those kind of stores, they might collect markers or they might collect printers and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. A lot of the time it's TerraCycle that will take that back. So as consumers, you can either go to stores and see if a store has a TerraCycle box, maybe encourage a store that sells candy to buy a TerraCycle box so you can come and bring your wrappers to that store. Or you can buy a TerraCycle box, you know, maybe get with your community and say, hey, we don't want all these wrappers to end up in a landfill. Do you want to, you know, put our money together and get a TerraCycle box and we just collect all our wrappers from Halloween and then you send the box back. You send the box back. So they do multiple things, you know.
Yeah, what will TerraCycle do with those wrappers then?
Right, so they take them and they dispose of them either properly, but most of the time they're taking all these items and, you know, upcycling or downcycling or creating other products out of what is being given, because most things are actually don't end up in our recycling bins, whether it's wrappers, whether it's a pair of shoes, anything like that. They can't go in our blue bins, right?
Mm-hmm.
They're not recyclable. But TerraCycle takes all these things and properly disposes and also, like I said, downcycles and upcycles into different things. You know, they might make a purse. I've read on their website that they take a lot of the plastic and they'll make benches with it and stuff like that.
We're going to talk more about plastic with Stephanie Morim, who hosts the podcast called Green Junkie, where she offers advice on how to live an eco-friendly life. We're focusing how to rein in the crazy amount of waste at Halloween. Parents, fellow parents, what are your kids dressing up as this year? Do you reuse costumes? How many Halloween candy wrappers end up in your trash bin? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Stephanie Morim here in the Ideas Network. We're discussing Halloween waste and what can be repurposed here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Are you prepping for a Halloween party? Are you shopping for costumes or decorations, candy? What about the pet costume? What will happen to your baby Yoda costume once Halloween is over? Not, by the way, asking for a friend there. Join in with your sustainable tips and tricks, 800-642-1234. Stephanie Morim is CEO of a company focusing on going green with us for about 9 more minutes. Stephanie, let's talk about plastic. Plastic is so sneaky. It shows up everywhere. And you see kids carrying the big plastic pumpkin from door to door. What would you suggest kids carry for their trick-or-treat bag?
Well, I think we should all go old school and just carry a pillowcase.
Me
like
too.
We did when we were kids.
Yeah.
They're big. You can collect a lot of candy in it. But, you know, definitely a pillowcase. Why not? You already have them in your house. Grab a reusable bag that you already have for grocery shopping. If you don't have a reusable bag, maybe a backpack, then you don't have to carry it. It's on your back, and you know, maybe your parents, you know, the parents can help get the candy in their backpack. Just use what you have around the house. I think it doesn't have to be complicated, and that's what I love to teach people. It doesn't have to be complicated to reduce your waste. It doesn't have to be complicated to live green. You just sometimes have to be creative and think outside of that box, you know, think outside of the candy box kind of thing, and not feel pressured that, oh, I have to go buy this new plastic pumpkin for my kid to carry around. If you really, really want the plastic pumpkin, I could probably guarantee you, you will find something at a thrift shop, like for sure.
It seems also a lot of Halloween decorations are plastic or foam, which means, you know, they're not sustainable, probably even toxic. What should we do for decorations?
So my daughter, was just her birthday, and she wanted to do kind of a scary theme. So it worked out well because she's born in October and it's Halloween. And we moved about a year ago, sold our condo, and now we can actually decorate outside, so it's pretty exciting. So what I did was I took to Facebook Marketplace, and I just searched Halloween decorations, and I found some people near me that were selling all their old Halloween decorations, all in great condition, and I bought it. And then we decorated our basement all spooky, and then we took those decorations and we put them outside. And I think the one thing is to try to keep your stuff in good condition, you know, to extend the life of your decoration, because then when you do want to resell it or you do want to donate, someone's going to want it. You know, I always, you know, say to people, no one wants a holy t-shirt, you know, like no one wants a t-shirt that's been donated with a big hole in it. So no one wants stuff that's broken, right? If you donate stuff to a thrift shop or to some sort of organization, and it's broken, they're just going to trash it. So, you know, try to extend, by extending the life of it, you'll be able to, you know, maybe sell it. So we bought all our stuff on Facebook Marketplace. Wasn't expensive compared to what we probably would have paid full price for all that stuff. And what we didn't want, we put aside and we donated to a thrift shop locally here that, you know, the money goes back into the community.
Yeah, that what a great idea. You know, what about pumpkins? Because more than a billion pounds of pumpkin go to landfill each year. And pumpkins, you know, they can decompose. They can go into compost. How should we sustainably dispose of all of those pumpkins after Halloween?
So I've actually been looking this up a little bit more. And I've been, one thing I've been reading that a lot of people do, which I never thought of doing, was instead of just even composting it, if you live near the woods, to just kind of open up your pumpkin and cut it up and throw it in the woods because an animal will eat it.
A
squirrel will eat your pumpkin. So that could be another way to, you know, I'm not advocating, you know, let's go all dump our trash in the middle of the woods or anything like that. But by maybe throwing your pumpkin, like an animal will eat it. But also people want to extend the life of their pumpkin. I've read some stuff on the internet, like bleach your pumpkin. I personally don't use bleach. And if you do bleach your pumpkin, please don't put it in the woods for animals to eat it. But I have read, I haven't actually tried it myself, but I did do some Google searches and I found that people will often spray their pumpkins with water and vinegar, and that extends the life of your pumpkin. And if an animal happens to eat your pumpkin, it's just vinegar and it shouldn't be too harmful to that animal. Also, you know, if you use gourds and stuff like that with your pumpkins, you could eat them after, you know, before they, you know, die, you can eat them. You can take out the pumpkin seeds out of the pumpkin. I love pumpkin seeds direct from a pumpkin.
Favorite.
I don't know why stores, like, Kate, I'm like, why can't stores make pumpkin seeds
all year round, right? Toasting those pumpkin seeds, little salt, good to go. Oh my goodness, yes.
They taste so delicious. So grab those pumpkin seeds, roast them, you know, make a pie, add them to a smoothie. Of course, you know, if your pumpkin maybe has been sitting outside for weeks and weeks and it's, you know, not very edible, compost it. You know, like you said, there are so many pumpkins that end up in our landfills. By composting, you're redirecting it from the landfill. And then better yet, like if an animal wants to eat your pumpkin, why not?
We have Stephanie Morin with us, teaches people how to live greener, protect the planet. We're focusing on reducing waste during the Halloween season, gathering your tips at 800-642-1234. Shauna is joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Shauna. What do you do for Halloween?
You might have touched but one of the things that I always try to do is do thrift shopping, but also I check my local Facebook groups for the buy sell trades to try and get things that have already been used, so that way I can make sure that I'm getting something that's easy on the pocketbook, but also I'm not going out and buying something that I'm going to use once or twice.
Yeah, that's such a great tip there, Stephanie. Another in the buy-sell trade camp.
Mm-hmm. And then the other thing I often do is I work at a school, and the students know that every year for Halloween, I dress up like a witch, and so I reuse that costume every year with sometimes different tweaks or different accessories, but I try and reuse that costume. Mostly because I like dressing up like a witch, but it's also a good way to reuse things.
Yeah, Shauna, great tip. Stephanie, Shauna creating like that legacy of always being a particular, a witch on Halloween.
I love that. And you're reusing your costume every year. And the kids probably anticipate like, oh, wonder what the little accessories are this year that she's going to put on with her witch costume. So it's kind of probably really cute for them, too.
Well, we're almost out of time here, but when looking ahead to Thanksgiving, to the holiday season, what should we think about and some mistakes that we might have in terms of being more sustainable?
This is a loaded question. I think the number one thing to maybe look at quickly is your food waste, the mm-hmm. amount of food that we're wasting all across the world, especially United States and Canada, and just kind of maybe when you're getting ready for that Thanksgiving dinner, to really make a list of what you actually need to buy for that dinner versus what you think you might need, and kind of divert that from the landfill. You know, buy what you need. Don't buy stuff on sale just because it's on sale and it's going to sit in the cupboard. If you don't eat cranberry sauce all the time, don't buy 10 cans, maybe just buy one. I think it's food waste is the number one problem that we're having when it comes to holidays,
mm-hmm.
Especially Thanksgiving and going into the rest of the holiday season. So just be mindful of that. Be mindful of what you're buying. And if you have leftovers, give them to your guests, freeze your leftovers. Your listener mentioned, the Buy Nothing group. They do food, a lot of those groups as well.
We'll explore that. Yeah. Stephanie, thank you for joining us. We appreciate it. Stephanie Morim, CEO and founder of Good Girl Gone Green and the Green Junkie podcast here on the IT.